Central Intelligence Agency takes weight faithfully. The finest type of China white and cocaine you'll see.
Honey, I'm home. Never mind when your bank account suddenly grown. It's funny, we're so out of this debt for this money we owe with ya. When have I told you that I had two governments overthrown to keep our son enrolled in a private school and to keep our tummy swollen? Come on, our home was built on a foundation of bloody throats, the hungry stolen of their souls. Of course, this country's running coke. I took a stunning oath to hush the ones who know. The CIA conducts the flow for these young hustlers that lust for dough.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS's NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He's currently a correspondent for Reuters covering the drug war in Mexico and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Thank you for having me on.
And this prison break up in Monterrey, apparently the 30 members of the violent Zeta drug cartel stabbed and bludgeoned 44 members of the rival Gulf cartel. And then that was a sort of a cover for a mass escape, which I think pretty clearly has implicated some of their prison authorities. Already the prison director and three other officials have been fired, along with 18 prison guards. Having seen this war up close, Joan, the Zetas are truly amongst the most violent, and it does seem that every time you hear of incidents in Mexico, it's hard to believe the level of brutality. What does this mean with all of these incredibly violent people now on the loose? Is this any worse, or is this just another day in the drug war?
No, I mean, certainly every incident we have to take very seriously, and it's, I know the level of violence has been so horrific here. Like you say, it's very hard to get complacent about these kind of horrific incidents, and suddenly 44 people being, you know, stabbed, bludgeoned to death, it no longer is, you know, a big story. So it's like, oh, you know, one more massacre in Mexico, so what's new? No, I mean, I think everything is very important. Now, this is actually the worst prison massacre in Mexico during the 5 years of President Felipe Calderon's campaign against drug gangs, and one of the worst prison massacres in its history. If you could imagine in a U.S. jail, 44 people being, you know, killed with short weapons. That would, you know, absolutely be stunning the whole world. So imagine the severity there. Now, as well as that, it is one more example of how the machinery of government is just failing to contain these people. Now, prisons themselves have shown themselves to be a real time bomb. You've got these prisons which are often state prisons like this one, not federal institutions, but state institutions, which really don't have the staff to kind of keep guard of these seasoned killers. And then you have so many assassins and cartel members being arrested and packing these jails that it's overwhelming the guards and the security in these places, overwhelming them with the force and overwhelming them with the money and power they have. Often the guards, you know, as they say, it's the old example of Bruma or Plata, the lead of a bullet or the silver of a bribe for these guards is under a very difficult choice for guards working in these institutions. So again, you see the prisoners, 30 of them left, and now, you know, after carrying out these massacres, are now at large doing these kind of activities. And other examples in prisons where more than 100 prisoners have escaped on single days. So again, Mexican prisons are not proving very good at holding or containing these inmates or the violence.
Well, but doesn't it sort of point, Joan Grillo, to the kind of dysfunctional nature of this war on drugs? If 30 to 40,000 people have been killed in this drug war, and the police have been clearly compromised, and the Zetas themselves, this violent gang, come out of an elite military unit, and they, most of the time they get away with murder, but when occasionally they're caught, they're able to escape en masse, it just seems completely broken, the system.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, the number you pointed out, it's now become even higher. The latest number says that more than 47,000 people in total have been killed in drug-related violence since Felipe Calderon came to power. So this does shine a big spotlight on the war on drugs. This is an attack on drug cartels and drug trafficking organizations. An attempt to seize and to burn down, to prohibit, to stop drug trafficking at the source. The tactic that's been developed, through assistance with the United States over several decades, it really shines a light on that whole strategy of trying to prohibit and try and stop drugs. And obviously, in the case of Mexico, things have got very bad. Now, it's gone beyond drugs in Mexico right now, because these organizations, they make billions of dollars trafficking heroin and crystal meth and marijuana and cocaine to Americans. They now use that money to create private armies with the real power to overwhelm the state. And they've moved into other activities. They're financed by drugs, but they've now moved into mass kidnapping, into extortion of businesses, even to stealing oil from Mexico's state oil monopoly, Pemex. They steal now $2 to $4 billion worth of oil every year. So it really is a critical situation, one of the worst drug wars in the history of drug culture and drug taking. And it really is a wake-up call to the world, to the United States, about what is happening in this country and among these policies.
There have been obviously a lot of friction between the Mexican government and the United States government over the war on drugs, where the Mexican authorities feel they're bearing the brunt of a war which there, you just mentioned the figure of 47,000 people have died in order to keep drugs flowing to their American customers. And we have this kind of attitude over here that there's some immaculate way that the drugs cross the border. And if there's only organized crime south of the border, there's no organized crime north of the border. And what the Mexican authorities complain about are the firearms that flood in from the United States into Mexico. I believe they've been putting up billboards near the U.S. border, haven't they, saying no more guns.
So that's correct. They actually made a sign out of guns. They got some people to hand in firearms. They're programming with people, handing in firearms in the house, and they crush all these weapons and use them to make a big thing saying, a monument against violence and saying no more guns, and facing the United States. And it is true, they have a very powerful point that an enormous amount of firearms are coming from gun shops, particularly in Texas and in Arizona. And where you can go to those shops and you can buy versions of the Kalashnikov assault rifle, which is the most popular weapon among Mexican drug cartels. They use the Kalashnikovs to spray rounds off in these murder scenes, which I've arrived at. You can see 300 to 500 bullets from these Kalashnikovs. They kill not only the targets that are after, but also the person driving behind, the person selling tacos on the side of the street, and many other people we've seen. Now, Kalashnikovs are manufactured, obviously originally a Russian rifle, and now manufactured in many countries, including Hungary and China and so forth, and in the United States itself, but they're sold largely in gun shops in the United States. Another common weapon of drug cartels in Mexico is the AR-15 assault rifle, the so-called civilian version of the M-16. And again, that's manufactured in the United States and sold in these gun shops in large quantities in Texas and in Arizona. And from there now, there was arguments sometimes about the percentages of weapons originating in the United States in the hands of Mexican drug cartels. And they've now traced more than 60,000 seized in recent years. That's the ones they've seized and captured. So we can say whatever the exact percentage is. I mean, weapons do come from other sources as well. There's weapons which are stolen from the Mexican military. There's weapons which are stolen from militaries in Central America and smuggled up to Mexico and used in this conflict. But we can say for certain that there are tens of thousands of guns being bought in American stores and being used to commit brutal murder in this country.
So, Joanne Grilla, here in the United States, we're responsible for, we're the customers for the drugs. We supply the arms, or at least a large portion of the arms that are responsible for the 47,000 deaths in Mexico. And yet, we in effect blame Mexico, and somehow our hands are clean, even though it's our money and guns that are driving this war. It's got to be incredibly frustrating for Calderon to in effect be bearing the brunt of America's war on drugs. He's the one that's paying the political price, isn't he?
Well, he certainly is kind of a political price. I mean, he also took a choice to accelerate this. He made certain choices when he entered office. There's different ways of fighting the war on drugs. There are presidents who uphold the law but don't but carried on to a step further and went from just saying we're going to uphold the law and arrest traffickers here and there to we're going to declare war. The very martial language used from when he entered office. One of his first moves was to dress up in a military uniform to go to a military base and address soldiers and use the kind of language like there'd be no quarter, on the enemies of the fatherland and this kind of thing. So he did raise the stakes. In some ways, he raised the climate in this country, and it wasn't successful. Perhaps he'd hoped for a kind of the same thing that happened during Ronald Reagan's administration, where Ronald Reagan sent gunboats down to Florida and kind of declared and spoke about fighting the cocaine barons in Miami. And after a couple of years, that was the kind of situation that kind of gone off the agenda and he moved on to other things. But in this situation, it really came back in his face. And no one predicted this conflict coming. I mean, if you ask anybody back 5 years ago, I've been covering this country for 11 years. And when Calderon first came in, we just had no idea we would suddenly come into this armed conflict, which would produce such devastation. I mean, as well as knowing the total numbers, just the kind of incidents we've seen, like mass graves with more than 200 bodies, a single massacre of 72 people, including a pregnant woman, and all kinds of horrific things that have passed during this conflict in the last 5 years.
So, in specifically, Juan Grillo, in terms of this prison break outside of Monterrey, where 30 members of the Zetas drug cartel escaped and they killed and bludgeoned to death 44 members of the rival Gulf cartel. And as we mentioned, the head of the prison and various other authorities have been arrested on suspicion of complicity. That doesn't come as a great surprise. But what's actually going on within the war on drugs, and that is the war between the Zetas, who evolved out of an elite military unit, and the Gulf cartel? Because my understanding is that El Chapo Guzman, the head of the Gulf cartel, is pretty much the capo di capo, isn't he? He's the number one guy in terms of the cartel leaders.
Well, yeah, you've had this this changing war, this moving scenario between these different warlords and these different armies of drug cartels. And as you said, the Zetas emerged originally back in the late 1990s. They were recruited by the head of the Gulf cartel, who at the time was called Osiel Galenas. And he recruited these people to be a private army to protect him. Back in the early 90s, the drug war was fought by street gang members, often some of them from California. Some of them were kind of Mexican-Americans from California who went over and recruited guys with tattoos and shaved heads and pistols. But the Zetas were actually military guys who were recruited by that person, and they formed this militia. And that really started to militarize this conflict in this country, because when they had a militia and began to fight with real firepower, with real military tactics, all the rest of the cartels felt they had to have the same tactics to stand the ground in this war. Now, as the Zetas became so powerful, they grew and grew and grew. And they recruited members all around Mexico, and even over the border in Guatemala, down to El Salvador, Honduras, and really started reaching, getting a major reach, moving to other activities, and eventually broke away from the Gulf cartel and formed their own criminal army, which is now one of the most powerful forces in this conflict. I mean, absolutely incredible, the resilience they have, their ability to withstand attacks from other cartels and to fight a conflict on so many different fronts. I mean, these are people who are managing to fight conflicts from Guatemala, and then all the way 1,000 miles away in Durango, and then in Tamaulipas, and they're managing to maintain fronts and really challenge the military and come face-to-face with the military. Now, Chapo Guzman, who you mentioned, is the other big power in this war. He's running the Sinaloa cartel on the other side of the country, and he's the kind of most powerful single gangster from an old family of gangsters from the mountains with the kind of old-style trafficking Golfo, again, a man of immense power who also stretches you know, his arm reaches right across down to Colombia and into South America and up to the United States. And again, a very, very powerful figure. So really, we haven't seen, despite all this violence, we haven't really seen a weakening in the overall power of drug trafficking organizations and their capacity to traffic drugs, to recruit people, or to confront the forces of the state.
So, Juan Grillo, the Sinaloa cartel headed by Chapo Guzman and the rival Gulf cartel, they've been at it, and now the Zetas who originally, as you have told us the story, came out of, were recruited by the Gulf cartel, and now they become a cartel and a force unto themselves. Are they do distribute drugs along with the other two, or are they specializing in kidnapping and brutality? I'm trying to get a sense of the differences between the cartels, if any.
Sure, yeah, sure. The Sinaloa cartel, which has its roots going back all the way back to the kind of early 20th century when Washington first made drugs illegal, they have their roots there in the opium growers of the Sierra Madre Mountains. That's their roots, and they've been a major drug trafficking organization. The Zetas, who began as a militia, they broke away from the Gulf cartel. The Gulf cartel, to survive now, have ended up allying with the Sinaloa cartel and become almost a front for the Sinaloa cartel against the Zetas. Now, the Zetas, as well as the mass kidnapping extortion, they also do continue the main business of trafficking drugs. And there's been, you know, various Zeta people quantities of marijuana, crystal meth, cocaine, and so forth. They didn't have the same kind of contacts in Colombia, the same ability always to move these transnational shipments, but they're getting more, you know, they're definitely getting very powerful at controlling territory on the ground, and it appears more and more capable in the international trafficking of drugs.
So how does this impact the upcoming elections? My understanding is that the pre-party is making a comeback, perhaps out of exhaustion with the war on drugs, that the Mexican people feel. It seems an irony that, given the history of the corruption in the pre-party, in many ways when they're in power, they kind of quietly regulated the drug cartels. They protected them and took their money and kept the peace. So it's an awfully sort of cynical irony, is it not, that the Mexican people could elect a government that has always been in complicity with the cartels and reject a government that is trying to clean up Dodge, if you will.
Well, I mean, that's one way to understand things. I mean, actually, the corruption relationship of government and corruption in Mexico is complicated. There's definitely a lot of corruption during the years of the PRI. I mean, it changed during decades and during different administrations. Sometimes there's accusations of it running right up to the presidents themselves. Now, other times, it's more of a system of corruption at lower levels. But there's continued to be accusations of corruption under the present government. We've also got accusations of corruption. The government itself is still saying, well, a lot of people, police, are on the payroll of drug cartels, and not only are acting to turn a blind eye, but are even acting as foreign assassins and kidnappers for these cartels. And there's some people who are accused, even the high levels of this government, could be in cahoots, where they haven't found conclusive evidence of that happening. So it's probably a bit of a simplification to say there was a kind of sudden change, but the people in Mexico are indeed fed up. Many people do say, well, we were better off under the days, during the days of one-party rule, under the PRI, who ran Mexico from 1929 till 2000. We were better off then. There was less insecurity. We felt better. We felt more secure in our homes, in our houses. We didn't have fear of going out at night and being in a crossfire, people firing at each other. We didn't worry about being kidnapped for ransom. So yeah, there's definitely that concern coming. We'll see if the PRI wins the election. We've got some other interesting candidates as well. And if the PRI does win the election, we'll still see if they are capable of restoring order and of reducing the violence in this country.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Juan Grillo.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Yohan Grillo, who's covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He's currently a correspondent for Reuters covering the drug war in Mexico and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.